At the Cullman, Alabama Civic Center, about an hour north of Birmingham, volunteers and National Guard troops unload cases of water, plopping them down off the back of a pickup truck.
They're all right in there. Go to the front.
A volunteer waves them into the building, the official shelter and command center since the Red Cross building here was destroyed. Inside, volunteers, response workers, and storm victims line up in the gym, eager to grab lunch.
That's a scene playing out across the state of Alabama earlier this week as thousands remained homeless and emergency personnel worked to transition folks from the aftermath of disaster to what should be a massive rebuilding effort. One local news reporter described the scene this weekend at Holt High School on the outskirts of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where they are coming together to reclaim their shattered community. They said that the supplies in the school gym, water, clothes, food, were outnumbered only by the volunteers ready to speed them to tornado victims. One of those volunteers, maybe not in that gym that day, but in Holt, is WOSU reporter Mandy Trimble. She returned to her home state to lend a hand, and she has come back to us and joins us today in the studio. Welcome to the show, and welcome back, Mandy.
Thank you, Ann.
When you and I talked earlier this week, you said that it was just at that point a door-to-door effort, going door-to-door asking how you could help. Tell us what you were doing and how things transpired.
Sure. Well, I drove overnight Thursday night and drove into Tuscaloosa Friday morning and straight to a volunteer coordination. It was at a church in just on the south end of Tuscaloosa, rather. It was highly uncoordinated. Of course, this was, less than 48 hours after it hit, and they were just getting folks together. That very first day, I went out with a chainsaw crew, and men cut down trees, myself and other volunteers, just made large piles of trees and limbs. And at that point, they sent us out into a small community called Brookwood, which is just outside the city limits of Tuscaloosa. It's to the east of Tuscaloosa. And it was a door-to-door effort. We went up to folks and said, do y'all need some help? And some people would say, no, we've got it under control. Others, gladly accepted the help.
What sort of help did you bring to them?
Well, on Friday, it was, just cleaning up their yards. Mm-hmm. It's growing up in Alabama, I'm used to tornadoes. Seeing all the pictures Wednesday night, trying to prepare myself to go down there, could not even begin to describe what it looks like.
I posted some of your pictures on mm-hmm. our Facebook page, by the way, at on my Facebook page, Ann Fisher. So if anyone wants to check those out, they can, and we'll move them over to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page as well. What did you see? Was it what you expected to see, or was it something else?
It was way worse. I can't even begin to describe. People, the cliche, a bomb went off. That's what it looks like. Trees looked huge, huge pine trees, oak trees looked like they'd just been stuck in a pencil sharpener. That's the best way I can describe it. Just snapped off, roofs off of houses, homes gone. But then there are other places where just trees were just down in everyone's backyard. I mean, that is really not a great description of what it looks like. It just depends on the area that you're in. Over in Brookwood and Fleetwood, where we were at on Friday, it varied from a home losing everything and then next door just their backyard just covered in trees. We helped an elderly couple clear their backyard because there was really no one there to even help them. Next door, the neighbor's roof was off. They had an infant. They had no plumbing. By the end of that afternoon, I guess it was the Red Cross had brought in porta-johns for these folks because they had no water, no plumbing, nothing.
How did you leave things as far as organizing volunteers and that sort of thing? How are people getting things together?
Well, by Sunday, things seemed to be more coordinated. Saturday, I worked at a shelter for part of the day, just entertained displaced children. And then the latter half of that day, I went out to the United Way, had like a temporary not a shelter, but just like a warehouse,
a
set
station.
For donations. And we made toiletry bags for people for about 4 hours. You don't think about that kind of stuff, but these people literally have nothing. They have no wash. They don't even have a washcloth. So we just got all of that kind of stuff together to send out into the community. That's what I did on Saturday. So
my guest is WOSU reporter Mandy Trimble. We're talking about the devastation in Alabama. Mandy, last week's storms killed more than 350 people at this point. It may have gone up. It seems to go up every day now. Hundreds more are still missing. How are people coping with that sort of tragedy there? Did you come across folks kind of trying to grapple with that in a personal way?
I didn't come across that personally. I think the most moving thing that happened to me was I was playing with a little boy on Saturday, and he wanted to go inside of this playroom at the shelter, and the ladies who were running it said, well, you need a parent or guardian to sign you in. And I said, well, you know, I'm just a volunteer. I don't know where mom or dad is. And he was only three, and I said, you know, can you show me where your mom is? And he took my hand, and, you know, we walked around the corner, and he pointed to an ambulance. And I said, honey, there's no one in there. And he just kept pointing to it. We finally located Grandma, and she just, I don't know if she was shell-shocked or what. She could never really, she just said, yes, this is my grandson. And, you know, we were able to get him into that room. But I don't know what happened to his mom. But it was just so moving that, you know, whether mom was hurt or if she died in this, I don't know, but it just was very moving.
The tornado that wrecked Tuscaloosa and Holt and other areas around there narrowly missed the campus of the University of Alabama, but Christopher England, director of Tide TV with the University of Alabama Athletic Department, Crimson Tide TV, I think, with the University of Alabama Athletic Department, was there when the tornado struck. He shot the tornado footage that has been shown on every major network and around the world. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thank you.
Tell us where you were during the storm and how you were able to shoot that amazing video.
Well, we were in Coleman Coliseum here on the campus of the University of Alabama, which is our basketball arena. And my office just happens to be in that building, and actually it just happens to be one of the safest places to be in Tuscaloosa. And we had just been in just pretty much in the office all day, and we had been, you know, had the television on, and we'd walked outside just to kind of see what we could see, and it was just raining, and we thought, well, maybe we dodged it again, because, you know, tornadoes aren't a common occurrence here, you know, per se, but, you know, severe weather is, you know, kind of this time of year, and we get a lot of warnings and watches, and so we thought, well, maybe, you know, we're okay, so we walked back inside, and we just, you know, kind of had the television on, but we were kind of working, and the power went off. And after a little bit, my boss and I, he said, you know, hey, let's go up to the third floor to see what we could see, because on our third floor there's a lot of windows that overlooks a parking lot between us and the DCH hospital. So we sprinted up the stairs just to see what we could see, and we had no idea that there was even a tornado on the ground. We had been kind of doing a photo shoot and kind of just playing around with the camera, and I just happened to have it with me. It was just a little still camera that shoots video, and as soon as we hit the top of the stairs, you know, we saw the tornado and really just didn't even expect it at all. I was just kind of in shock for a little bit, and my boss said, hey, let's go, and he turned around and went back down the steps, and I followed him, and then I don't know what made me do it, but I just kind of turned around. I guess I realized, hey, I have a camera, and, you know, I maybe need to capture this for people to see, you know, just how bad it was.
Have you ever seen a tornado before that day?
I have not. I had been in one when I was a little kid, but we were at a campground, and, you know, we got inside one of the bathrooms, you know, like they have at campgrounds, mm-hmm. and it kind of picked the car up and moved it over, but I never saw it. So for me personally, this is the first time I've ever seen one in person. And, I mean, you see them, you know, on movies and on television, but to see that is nothing like it. I've never seen anything like that at all. And they said, it, you know, it was up to a mile wide, maybe right. A little more. And, I mean, I really believe it just from, you know, seeing it.
Yeah, that's the impression I get, particularly because of the way you were able to shoot it. There was a lot of contrast in the environment there, the trees, the buildings, that kind of a thing. It just looked like like a King Kong coming over the horizon.
Well, you can see the building that it's going towards, if you've seen the video, towards the end is the hospital. And the hospital is not a small building by any means. And the tornado just dwarfs the hospital. And when we saw it, when I saw it, you don't really know what it's doing on the ground. You know it's doing some damage, but you really just don't know what it's doing. And then afterwards the next day to go down and to all the neighborhoods, I mean, it's really widespread, the devastation. And just to see how much it is and how wide it is really just hard to believe.
Could you feel the tornado?
I could a little bit, yes. People have asked me, did I hear anything? And I went back and watched it, and I could actually hear, a little something on the video. But at the time, I really didn't think that I could hear anything. But I guess towards the end, I guess I kind of could feel the pressure a little bit. I was kind of next to the windows shooting there, and I could kind of feel the pressure on the windows and just kind of feel the pressure up there. And actually, towards the end of the video, just rewatching it just yesterday, I could hear the top of Coleman kind of creaking a little bit, and that's kind of the first time I had really noticed that. But like I said, it's just something hard to believe, something you hope you never see.
We talked about how the tornado missed the campus amazingly. How close did it come?
It wasn't very far from campus at all. Maybe just maybe like 10 blocks. I'm just kind of guessing, but it wasn't very far. I mean, you could see. I mean, I was on, just the edge of campus there in Coleman Coliseum. It's kind of on the edge of our campus, and it came just very close to us. The hospital is just right down the street from us, and it kind of passed behind the hospital. But there are a couple of neighborhoods, that are right there next to us that many of us go through every day on our way to work, and, those neighborhoods are gone.
Christopher England, you're a filmmaker. Do you plan on using this footage to maybe extrapolate from this footage a longer story?
I don't know. I really haven't thought about that yet. It's still, it's still hard. I just went home last night. I didn't get power back until I think it was like late Tuesday night, which is nothing, and I'm thankful compared to most people who don't have a home. But, when you see all this around, I just haven't really thought about that yet. I just really haven't.
Well, I want to thank you I hope everybody, your friends and family, everyone is safe.
They are. They are. A friend of mine, he lived next to the Krispy Kreme that's at McFarland and 15th, pretty much where it did a lot of devastation. And the only thing left of his house is the dirt that was there. The foundation is gone. And he got inside the bathtub, and somehow he's still alive. I mean, he said he shouldn't be here, and he doesn't know how. He said he felt the tornado pick the bathtub up and flip him upside down and threw him out. And I think he was knocked unconscious. His knee is torn up, and he looks like he was just beat to death. He's got black, whips all around him, and he's got probably the size of a DVD mark on his side that's just solid black, but he's still alive. And I mean, it's, just God bless that that he's okay. But there's so many stories like that, and unfortunately there's people that don't have stories like that. But it's just, as your guest Mandy said earlier, it's just hard to believe. Unless you're really there, on the ground, the pictures and the video just really don't do it justice.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Christopher England.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Roll Tide, Christopher.
Roll Tide, Mandy.
And Mandy Trimble of WOSU, Christopher England of Tide TV at the University of Alabama Athletic Department. And as you can tell, they're both alumni of the University of Alabama. Thanks again, Mandy, for joining us. When we return, we will hear more about another tornado from 37 years ago. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Go Good morning. This is 89.7 NPR News. Get access to our station anytime online at WOSU.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen to 89.7 NPR News online anytime at WOSU.org. And there are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. 45 degrees in downtown Columbus under cloudy skies. There is a slight chance of rain today. Cloudy skies throughout the day and a high of 57. Clouds tonight, a low of 36 degrees. Areas of frost Thursday morning, then sunshine promised in the afternoon and a high of 65. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Let's hear from an interview with Ohio Governor John Gilligan in 1974.
The tornado evidently went virtually right through the middle of the town. I've never seen a community hit any harder than this one is. It looks like they've had a 300-plane raid here or something, and it's the devastation is very widespread.
That was Ohio Governor John Gilligan after surveying the April 3, 1974 tornado damage to Xenia, Ohio. That storm killed 32 people from Xenia to Wilberforce. About half of the buildings in the city of 27,000 were damaged and 300 homes destroyed. 9 Xenia churches were destroyed, as were 7 of the 12 schools in the city. Storm hit about an hour after classes had let out for the day, and our next guest recalls almost every minute of that day as if it happened a week ago. Mark Steiner was 15 years old that day. He joins us today to share his memories. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Good morning.
You only started talking about the 1974 storm a few years ago.
Yeah, well, I had a friend, Kent Scannell, a friend of mine in high school. I had dug him after the tornado hit, and he passed away last year. It made me rethink about this. For eons, I could not discuss this because it was very personal to me, but I've decided to discuss it. So I contacted the Xenia paper a couple months ago and finally started talking to people outside of my family about it.
That's where I found your interview, was in the Xenia Gazette, and you'd written about it before, though. You'd written an essay about it.
Yeah, another tornado hit Xenia in 2000, and I was with my two kids that day, and I saw it, and it brought back the feelings, I guess, and the memories of what happened. So I decided to write down my memories back in 2000 about this. I wrote a 5-page story about what happened, about recollections, and I had pretty good memory about it, so I did that in 2000.
I do love the detail of your recollection. Tell us, you'd just gotten out of school, which is the miracle of the day, really, that school had been called off otherwise, or had been let out for the day otherwise. Heaven only knows, right?
Right. Actually, President Nixon had moved up daylight savings an hour, so normally the tornado would have hit when school was out, and that would have been disastrous.
Okay, I'll never curse daylight savings again. But tell us, you left school with your brother or a friend that day?
Yeah, we got home, my brother Bob and I. We went and shot basketball down a little street called Treaty Lane off our street, Peace Pipe Trail. It started raining. We went home. We went into the house, and the music was playing on the radio, and my mom said that there was a tornado in Cincinnati, so we knew tornadoes came from the south. So we looked in the southwest, and we saw these two tornadoes. My mom recalled seeing 3, and I think there were 3, but my memory only remembers 2. We watched them form. We got very nervous. I've got a longer story. I'll try to keep it short. We ran to our neighbor's house, ran into their house, and announced that a tornado was coming. We went to the back, and we watched the tornado form. It was moving directly at us, so it was looked like, from our perspective, it was standing still. It became very wide. We looked at the base of the tornado, and we saw the houses exploding and being destroyed, and it was plowing directly towards us. We ran into the basement. The power was out. The house, it was very quiet, no lights. The basement was dark. I heard a rumble like a thunder in the background, but it kept getting louder and louder, and it got very loud. The house pressure on my ears. The house blew up very quickly, like a can of pop opening. There was a lot of wind in the basement. Debris was flying around. We almost got hit. My brother grabbed my legs. The wind picked me up. The tornado went over us. That was a terrible experience. But right after it went over, I stuck my head out of the house. The entire house was gone. There were a couple of plumbing pipes sticking out. That was the only thing that was left. The tornado was across the street from us. It was plowing through the apple orchard. I watched it head downtown. I watched the trees flying. I saw debris up in the tornado, and I just watched it go down through downtown. I looked around, and our entire plat was flattened, just like I've heard other people describe Alabama, like a nuclear bomb had hit. I had no idea what was going on. We thought all tornadoes were the Wizard of Oz-type tornadoes.
Yeah.
So that's the short version of what happened.
You were 15 years old. How did it affect you at the time?
Well, I was never thought of myself as being mortal. I didn't realize I could die. I remembered when it went over, one of the feelings right after it went over, I couldn't believe I was alive. I realized I was thankful for being alive. The terrible injuries afterwards and the bad things that happened reinforced that. I realized the magnitude of what happened. For some reason, I remember every detail. I remember the smells, the sounds of everything.
You remember the song that was playing?
Oh, yeah. When we came into the house, it was Midnight at the Oasis. I remember her voice. And every time I hear that song on the radio, it reminds me of the tornado. And it got interrupted by an announcement from back then. The weather statements were a lot different than they were today, you know. But, yeah, the song was on the radio. It still sticks in my mind.
Your dad didn't know where you were. He was separated from the family. He was at work that day.
Yeah, he found out. Some people at work jokingly told him that, you know, people laugh about it in jest that Zinga was wiped out by a tornado. He got very concerned, jumped in the car, tried to drive home.
Where was he at the time?
He was in Kettering. He was working
okay.
In Kettering. Had to do a bypass, a street called Van Eaton Road, had to cross where the tornado did its early damage. There were dead cattle and pigs on the road, and he had to park his car. He had to run through the damage to get to our house, and he found us, and he was elated to find out that we were alive after seeing all the trauma leading up to getting to the house.
Is there anything left besides songs and when there's other reports of tornadoes that jogs your memory sometimes in unexpected ways?
Well, I still get terrified by storms. Every time for years I couldn't watch anything on TV about this, and even when I see the towns destroyed, it looks just like Zinga. I feel sorry for the people in Alabama. And I was sitting in the airport traveling last week, and I saw the images. I was a captive in the CNN screens at the airport, and I saw the destruction. So that's probably the most I've watched of towns being destroyed. But just the stories about them, I have a lot of empathy for those people. The emotional memory of it, the material losses really are meaningless compared to that we were happy to be alive. I knew people that died. It's just a nightmare emotionally. I'm thankful for the support afterwards. The Red Cross helped us out, gave us food and water, that kind of stuff. And the people are in Alabama, what they're going through today, any support they get, psychological, you can't measure. Everybody sees the physical stuff. But 6 months from now, when that's all gone, the people that survive that, they're going to be going through psychological memories. So I really appreciate what they're going through.
You know, it's amazing sometimes how little we know when we talk to meteorologists and experts about tornadoes. One of the things they always tell me is, you know, we really don't know that much about tornadoes. There's still a lot of mystery surrounding them. And joining us now is Mary Jo Parker. She's a warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service Weather Forecast Office in Wilmington, Ohio. Mary Jo, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
When these kinds of catastrophes occur in Zinga, for example, and then last week in Alabama and across the South, how much can we learn from each episode?
Well, we try and learn as much as we can, and one of the ways that we do that is by doing damage surveys, for example, going out to the areas and finding out exactly what did occur. These days, we can look at the forecasts that were made. We can look at some of the models, forecast models, and how they handled it, what they can tell us about conditions that are necessary for these events. and hopefully even try and review some of the safety rules and see if there's any improvement that can be done in those areas.
They're saying that the ingredients were perfect for a tornado outbreak last week and that it was kind of, someone referred, called it a textbook example.
Yes. For example, with the Xenia tornado and last week, you can end up with some very intense upper-level low-pressure systems. With the Xenia tornado, conditions were very ripe for these tornadoes. There was a lot of moisture that was transported northward ahead of this upper-level low, an unusually broad and warm, moist area for early April for that time of year. And then a strong upper-level jet streak or strong upper-level winds, which also provides some of the what we call shear, which is the difference in speed or direction of the wind that's necessary for these types of events to form.
I think what was really freaky to a lot of people last week was how many tornadoes popped up almost at the same time.
That's right. This is a really large outbreak. Prior to this, Xenia was the largest outbreak that we'd seen in numbers of tornadoes.
How many were in Xenia in 74?
The 74 outbreak had approximately 148 tornadoes. And the latest count for last week's events, for our estimate, is roughly 305. And we still have surveys ongoing, so that number may change.
So when you say you have surveys ongoing, what do those consist of?
That's generally when meteorologists from the different offices go out and they actually look at damage that's occurred. They talk to people that have actually experienced the event and put all that information together with what they know of through radar and other technology to determine the exact tracks of tornadoes, the intensities of tornadoes, and the times that they occurred.
One of the things that felt really different about the occurrence last week was that it occurred in a relatively large metropolitan area. There were a lot of people around, and of course it went right down the main street in Xenia in 1974, but that what was shocking about that too was how many people were affected almost at the same time. Is there any topographical clues to how tornadoes hit, or is that irrelevant?
No, there really isn't. You know, there is a myth that's held by some people that if you're in a big city, you really can't get hit by a tornado, and that's not true. We have seen tornadoes prior to last week in places like Miami, Salt Lake City. So larger areas are susceptible to tornadoes as well.
Mark Steiner, I have to say goodbye to you now. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, well, you're welcome.
Mark Steiner, he was an eyewitness to the 1974 tornado in Xenia, Ohio. My guest right now is Mary Jo Parker. She's with the National Weather Service, where she's a warning coordination meteorologist at the Weather Forecast Office in Wilmington. Mary Jo, what have we learned? I mean, do we essentially know anything much different now about tornadoes than we did back in 1974?
Oh, yes, we've learned a lot about tornadoes since then. We've learned a lot about these types of large storms called supercells, which produce some of the larger, longer track tornadoes. We've learned with the more updated technology, such as Doppler radar, we've been able to provide better warnings for people with these types of storms. So there is a lot we have learned in the years since Xenia. One other thing that's improved since Xenia is that we now have a better NOAA weather radio network throughout the United States. And in fact, the 74 outbreak was one of the things that prompted the further development of that network.
What about the early occurrence of these tornadoes? Now, back in 74, that was early, obviously, too, but there had been even earlier tornadoes this season back in March, right? And that was very unusual.
Right. Well, it depends on where you are in the United States.
Sure.
The southern states have a higher tornado threat earlier in the year because they do start to experience those conditions earlier than we do, per se. But really, here in Ohio, we can be prone to tornadoes almost any time during the year, depending on what conditions we see. So while it's unusual maybe to see one in January or February, it's not unknown.
What are you confident that people really pay attention to the sirens? For instance, I've never seen a tornado before. I've never been around one, but I've been around countless tornado warning sirens.
Right. You know, we do a lot of public education. We try and let people know what actions they should take when a warning is issued. And we hope that people do take that seriously. Because it does save lives if people take the appropriate action.
What about the sirens? Has there ever been any thought to changing the sirens like police do with their sirens now?
Not sure what the question is.
Well, the sirens sound the same now as they did, or it seems like they did 20 years ago.
Well, I know I'm not an expert on sirens, and the National mm-hmm. Weather Service doesn't, you know, do anything with sirens. But I am aware that in different areas, there are different types of sirens. So it's really something people should check on in their local area.
We've read the dispatch this morning, I think. It said that we're going to have a rainy May. We're going to have maybe one of the rainiest on record. Does that necessarily bode ill for the tornado season or not? Does it kind of not have anything to do with it?
I don't think we can extrapolate, you know, the fact of having a rainy spring season into a more active tornado season necessarily. It's just that we do have a lot more weather systems moving through the area. So,
when I talked with Mark Steiner earlier this week, he mentioned that there was this moment where everything sort of felt weird. There wasn't any rain, there wasn't anything, but the color of the sky changed. It got green. What is that? Why you hear people describe that in other incidents? What are they seeing?
Well, the green color generally is because you've got hail associated with that storm, somewhere in the storm. And when you have light, sunlight that goes through that part of the storm, because of the hail, the color green shows up. The refraction of the color ends up looking green.
We have an email from Tom in Lucasville, Ohio, writes, my grandmother was in the hospital in Dayton. She was taken there by an aunt who lived on Dayton Xenia Road in Beaver Creek. I remember going with my parents and brother to see her the day after the tornado hit when I was 6 years old. I have vivid memories of the uprooted trees and dead cattle we saw alongside the road as we went to the hospital. I do remember a woman in the room next to my grandmother who had been injured in the tornado. My dad said that she was in a room with wall-to-wall carpeting and that the tornado had taken the roof off her house, pulled the carpet from the floor, wrapping her in it, and carried it a long distance from her home. When the tornado released her, she was hurt. I presume she recovered, but don't know for certain. It's amazing. You know, we heard another story from Christopher England in Alabama about the guy who was thrown around in the bathtub and survived. Are tornadoes uniformly, I know there's some that are bigger than others, but the actual strength of a tornado, you know, square foot for square foot, are we able to measure things like that and know how they come across in terms of power?
Well, what we do, we can't really measure it necessarily before they strike, mm-hmm. Although with Doppler radar, we do get estimates of wind speeds. But what we do is when we do these surveys, we look at the damage that's occurred, and we have a scale that we use, an enhanced Fujita scale, which we can then, depending on the types of buildings damaged and the extent of damage, we can infer what the wind speeds may have been with a particular storm.
Mary Jo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, glad to do it.
Appreciate it. That's Mary Jo Parker. She's warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service at its weather forecast office in Wilmington, Ohio. We're going to come back and talk about the women of rock and roll. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
For as little as $60 per year, you can support 89.7 NPR News. With a basic membership, you receive the WOSU member card, good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine. And you will automatically receive our electronic airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. To support the programs you love, sign up for a basic membership today. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Signs begins and a discussion of the Ohioana Book Festival. Join us as we discuss the book festival, and joining us will be several authors of children's fiction and also a mystery author. That's on All Signs with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
Discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher online at wosu.org/allsides. You can listen to new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. Visit wosu.org/allsides. And it's 45 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, a high of 57. Clouds tonight, a low of 36 degrees. And sunshine for Thursday, a high of 65. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
That's Janis Joplin singing Piece of My Heart live at Woodstock in 1968. Janis was groundbreaking as a female rock and roll artist who lived like one of the guys, dying of a drug overdose at the age of 27. Women have played an important role in rock and roll from its beginning to the present, but only now is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame recognizing that with a new exhibit opening in about a week and a half. It's called Women Who Rock. Susan Whitehall covers pop culture for the Detroit News. She's the author of Women of Motown and is currently working on a biography of R&B legend Little Willie John. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
Stevie Nicks said that seeing Joplin perform changed her destiny because of the connection Janis created with her audience. What makes Janis Joplin's career so groundbreaking?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, she's a direct link to all those great blues shouters like Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith. She's got that. But she has this extra supercharged kind of acid, hippie kind of thing. She was definitely a product of her time and place, San Francisco, the 60s. So she had that extra hard rocking edge that was so exciting.
And yet she was very vulnerable. She was not a woman necessarily in charge of her own destiny.
Yes and no. I mean, she was out there, you know, having boyfriends and singing about it and being very ballsy about that. But, you know, yeah, she showed some vulnerability, but she wasn't like the earlier generation of women where it was like, please don't leave me and I love you so much and, you know.
And she wasn't girly.
No, no girly, no girliness at all.
Did she have any peers at the time?
Not really, which is what makes her such an original in terms of that kind of attitude and presentation.
You know, would rock and roll even be the same without women artists?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, so many of the early ones were you know, female artists as well. But I think what women brought to it was a fresh viewpoint. We'd heard so many male voices and male stories, but to hear the girls' stories is exciting, especially for, you know, a female audience. You want to hear someone who sounds like you and, you know, expressing teenage concerns or the concerns of young women.
You wrote the book, The Women of Motown. That was a specific era. Then there was the likes of Janis Joplin. What other sort of turning points have there been for women in rock and roll?
Well, the girl group era, you know, it did start out very girly with in the 50s with the Chantels and all that, very sweet voices. And then in terms of Motown and Detroit, in 1961, the Marvelettes were extremely important. And with Please, Mr. Postman, that kind of kick-started a whole new girl group era, and that followed the Shirelles and the Shangri-Las, and it got a little harder-edged as the decade wore on. So you have the Shangri-Las with their kind of bad girl image and black leather. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a huge, I think we kind of forget that it was a huge fad in the early 60s, these girl groups. It was very exciting. And it had added a whole new perspective to rock, where we'd had the teenage boy idols. We'd already been through that. So this was sort of a fresh face on music.
Janis Joplin was archetypal rock star, but she wasn't the first female rock and roll artist. Let's hear from Aretha.
Hey, what you want, huh?
Aretha Franklin is called the Queen of Soul, and Rolling Stone magazine ranked her as the greatest singer of all times. There she was singing the hit Respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, which was originally written for a male singer, and she reversed the gender. She was also the first female artist inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but not until its second year in 1987. Joining us now, Meredith Rutledge is the assistant curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and is lead curator for Women Who Rock, Vision, Passion, Power. Welcome to the show, Meredith.
Thank you for having me.
Did you think it was about time, or what spurred the exhibit today in 2011?
Wow. Well, I have been working for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for almost 15 years, and it's really been a dream of mine to have a Women in Rock exhibit here. And now that it's actually happening, it's almost like I can hardly believe it. It's such a wonderful thing, and about time, definitely.
Was it intended to put some more gender balance into the museum overall, or will it go away and it'll return to the same?
Well, we hope not. You know, I mean, we don't want this to be a situation of, okay, well, we've assuaged the women now, so we can move on and go back to the boys with guitars. Women, we hope that this exhibit will open the floodgates, as it were, and really educate people about the role that women have played in moving the women or moving the music forward since the beginning of popular music, since the roots of rock and roll.
How do you break down the exhibit in terms of eras?
It's basically divided into eight sections, starting in the 1920s with what we call the foremothers, the roots of rock and roll, people like Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, Ma Rainey, Mother Maybelle Carter. And we go all the way through to today, artists like Lady Gaga, Carrie Underwood, Alicia Keys. And in each of the eight sections, we have biographies of the artists. Some are inductees, some are lesser-known artists that maybe a lot of people haven't really heard of, and we tell their stories.
Susan, are there any stories you're afraid might get lost in the shuffle? Susan Whitehall from the Detroit News.
Yeah, in terms of women, I think the Marvelettes need to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
This is your chance to make your pitch.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, Meredith, how you decide. Are the criteria for who gets inducted as far as the women are concerned the same as for the male rockers?
The fact of the matter is that the music industry in general and rock and roll, our society in general has really been very male-oriented, male-driven. And so while on the surface the criteria is the same, it really is a situation where, you know, women have to be overachievers. They have to do the job that a man does three times or more better to even be noticed to have a seat at the table. And I think you know, it's getting better. And I hope that this exhibit will be an eye-opener for people and make things easier and sort of level the playing field, as it were.
Susan Whitehall, what do you think is what held women back was the lack of access to the money, the control, the major control factor when it comes to the music industry?
In terms of the being in control?
Yeah.
The artist, you mean?
Yes.
I'm not sure that really plays in. There were some really key women executives back in the day. I know certainly at Motown, Berry Gordy empowered his sisters. They were executives.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to say about Aretha, she had this self-possession and still does that I also heard in Janis Joplin. Very, very self-possessed, very confident, that I think was extremely empowering for women to hear in the 60s.
Well, let's hear from another very confident, extremely confident person, Madonna. Madonna, she was something that I sat up and noticed her in the 80s. I didn't know if I necessarily liked her music, but she sure did make you notice her. Susan?
Oh, absolutely. I really liked her early stuff almost the best because, you know, Borderline really sounded like she grew up in Detroit and listened to a lot of soul music. It was very soulful. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of female empowerment, you really... I once reviewed a Chicago show of hers where she ended up in a pose where she had her foot on a male dancer's throat.
Yeah.
And I wrote up in my review that, you know, this was female dominance kind of thing. And I got word through from her publicist. She said, Madonna said you're the only one who got that. So, you know, she took over her career. She started her own record company. Yeah, she pretty much did it all. And nobody told her what to do.
Meredith Rutledge at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how do you embrace someone like Madonna in an exhibit like this? And I suppose someone like Lady Gaga, for that matter.
Right. Well, you know, we certainly talk about how Madonna really changed the game in a lot of ways, just in terms of being completely in control of her career, her image, and being the reinventor, the queen of reinvention, and in so doing, sparking controversy, but making it work for her, staying at the top of the charts. She really was the game to beat, and I think that Lady Gaga is, you know, sort of the next generation. Has taken all of those lessons to heart. And the thing that I find so compelling about Lady Gaga is, you know, the spectacle of Lady Gaga is there to get your attention. And then once she has your attention, she really has something to say, which I think is very powerful. And I think it's a great message, not only for women, but just for our culture in general.
Susan, do great women rockers appeal to both men and women?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of watching a rock star, a rock group, is thinking, oh, that, you know, that the image, that person is very attractive to me, and that's been a big part of it. So you're not only identifying with it if you're the same sex, but, you know, you're aspiring to know that person. They love watching women.
And what about the costumes? How big of a deal is that with the women compared to, say, the men? And obviously, some of the men have had some outrageous costumes, by the way.
Sure, but, yeah, I know, for instance, the Motown women used to say, you know, and the Dick Clark tours of the 60s, that women had a tough time because they had a real image to uphold after sleeping all night in a bus. They had to get wigs, and they had to try and really put on the glam, where the guys just had to be clean, you know.
You couldn't wait when the Supremes performed on television. You just were half waiting for what they were going to come out wearing.
Absolutely. Whereas, you know, Marvin Gaye had a little mohair suit, and that's, then he was done.
Right. So that must have made the exhibit a lot of fun to put together, too, Meredith Rutledge.
Absolutely. There's so many beautiful costumes, ranging from some of the Supremes gowns to going back to Lady Gaga. You know, we have some pretty amazing stuff from her. Back in the 70s, you know, we've got this amazing outfit that Cher wore for the premiere of her Half Breed song on the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. But we didn't want this to be just a fashion show.
Mm-hmm.
We've got instruments, handwritten lyrics, contracts, things that really show these women as artists and not just fashion plates. Not that fashion isn't important, but we really wanted to show the totality of the artistry of these people.
So how do women stand up at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? How many are there who have been inducted and compared to the men?
Sort of reflective of the music industry, our female inductees are 9% of the inductees, which is kind of a small number based on, you know, how many female artists there are, the proportion of the population that women are. As I said, I'm hopeful that this exhibit is going to really sort of open the floodgates and level the playing field.
And how many are being inducted in conjunction with the exhibit?
The inductions are separate from our exhibit.
Okay.
We do our inductions in March, and we just inducted a class of people, including Darlene Love, Dr. John, Tom Waits, Alice Cooper, Neil Diamond, Leanne Russell.
Can't argue with any of those.
That's right. That's right. And Darlene Love actually is going to be here for the exhibit opening because we're having a benefit concert. And Darlene Love, Cyndi Lauper, and another inductee that's going to be here is Mavis Staples. We're really excited about that.
The opening's May 12th, right?
May 13th,
okay.
And the benefit concert is May 15th.
That's Meredith Rutledge, curator of Women of Rock. She is at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Meredith, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And Susan Whitehall, she's a feature writer from the Detroit News and critic and author of The Women of Motown. Thanks for joining us again, Susan. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.